I'm Rebecca Bryant from Hellenic Observatory, and I'm very pleased to introduce our two speakers today, Effie Focas and Margarita Marcoviti. They're both longtime friends of the European Institute and the Hellenic Observatory. Effie, you've had an affiliation for 10 years. Effie has produced many publications with the Hellenic Observatory as her affiliation, and Margarita received her PhD from here. So we're very pleased to welcome them back. And they're going to be talking today about a European Research Council-funded project that Effie has been the principal investigator for and that Margarita has been working on, called Grassroots Mobilizations in the Shadow of European Court of Human Rights Religious Freedoms Jurisprudence. And they'll be explaining to us, I think, exactly what they mean by that. And we very much look forward to their talk, which is entitled The Radiating Effects of the European Court of Human Rights in a Context of Prevailing Religion and Increasing Religious Pluralism. So we have maybe 45 minutes.
Lovely. Thank you. Thank you, Rebecca. It's really nice to be here and very nice to see you all, many familiar faces and many new faces. I have put on the slide the full title of the project because, as you saw, it's long and hard to...
If you press F5.
Yeah, that's it. There we go.
No.
No, that's
not
the
right one.
Oh, that one, okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, okay.
So my role here tonight is to provide some background to what Margarita will be telling you about, the Greek case study in this particular research project, the title of which is a subtitle there. It is a five-year project. We're just entering the fourth year. I've just entered the fourth year in the project. And I just wanted to give you some of the background to the research as a whole, in which the Greek case study is embedded. And I'll start by telling you a true story example of grassroots mobilizations in the Greek context. And it's actually a story about what inspired me to apply to the European Research Council for this particular research project. As some of you may know, in 2009, the European Court of Human Rights took a decision in a case called Lauzi versus Italy, in which the court declared that the display of the crucifix in Italian public schools was in violation of the right of parents to educate their children in accordance with their own philosophical or religious beliefs. The case caused a stir, certainly in the Italian government. The Italian government immediately asked for it to be revisited, and it was going to be revisited. The Grand Chamber of the European Court of Human Rights agreed to revisit the case. Soon after that decision, I was speaking to a public of mainly clerics, theologians, and general church-going public in Volos. And I was speaking alongside someone else on my panel who was presenting the Lauzi case, and the audience was quickly incensed. And we had a cleric stand up very soon after the presentation. He declared that he was sure that the decision would be overturned, and he was absolutely sure that that basically the court would see the light and understand that this was a very poor decision, and that we could, in the aftermath of that decision, think in terms of how to protect our religious symbols from Europe. These are the words that he used. And he had a plan for this. His idea was that we just need to nationalize our religious symbols, to make them, present them more in national terms, that they're something about our culture and national identity, because he said the European Union and the European Court of Human Rights is more friendly towards national identity and towards culture than it is towards religion. And so this is the idea. And so he was ready to mobilize people on this basis and proposing that this is what we need to do and getting everyone excited about this concept. I was thinking this is very much counter to what the European Court of Human Rights was having in mind when they took this decision, because in the end, there, in the Greek case at least, they're leading a already pretty nationalist-tending church to think in more nationalistic terms. So this is just one kind of example of unintended consequences of the European Court of Human Rights case law. In the end, the cleric was right. The decision was overturned. 2 years later, it was revisited by the Grand Chamber and the court, and it went from a decision that was an absolute majority in the chamber in the 2009 original decision to a 15-2 reversal of the decision. And that happened after really intense grass tops mobilizations. So 10 NGOs, 33 members of the European Parliament, and 10 national governments, Greek government included, intervened in the case and asked for a reversal of the decision. Actually, not all, most of those interveners were asking for a reversal of the decision. And it was quite a powerful intervention. It was actually the first time so many national governments had intervened in any case in the European Court of Human Rights. It was really interesting that it was a religion-related case that mobilized so many people. So this is, in a nutshell, is kind of what this research is about, but not limited to the Laozi case. I, in the project, study grass tops mobilizations. I do research with actors working at the European level and internationally, actors based in the U.S. who may be trying to influence what gets on the court's agenda, and I try to understand why and to what effects. You know, how are they somehow trying to influence what the court is seeing in terms of case law and what the court's deciding. It's very much a taboo issue because no one wants to admit that judges are influenced in any way, but it's also kind of obvious. In the research project, there are five postdoctoral researchers across four countries studying grassroots mobilizations in those four countries. And these are Greece, Italy, Romania, and Turkey. And Margarita does research for the Greek case study. And the emphasis is certainly on the grassroots research in this project. And its central aim is to understand to what extent do people at the grassroots level know about the European Court of Human Rights decisions related to religion, and to what extent do they use them to gain new rights? Is it actually having some impact at the grassroots level? And European institutions get a lot of slack for being very distant from the publics that they serve, and for working in a very top-down manner. So this research is very much bottom-up, research conducted at the grassroots level, trying to understand what people know about the court, how they use the court, and to what extent they find it helpful. I don't mean not the court directly, the court's decisions, the court's case law. We defined religion-related very broadly. So we're looking only at religion-related case law, but we define it broadly, not just something to do directly with religion, but decisions that might mobilize a religious public, for example, same-sex marriage, or decisions that might mobilize a secularist public, like icons in courtrooms in the Greek case. So it makes a very, I'd say, exciting study in that sense. We're a multidisciplinary research team, comprised of anthropologists, political scientists, sociologists, and one lawyer, who makes it all more fun. And we use a combination. It's a real challenge, actually. We speak all different languages, but it is fun. And we use a combination of different quantitative and qualitative research methods, but the emphasis is on the qualitative, and we have a lot of in-depth interviews conducted for the research across the four countries. And we also have, in addition to a range of disciplines and research methods, a range of thematic foci, so it is easier to do a cross-country comparison. So one of these is social and bioethics, things like reproductive rights or same-sex marriage, as I mentioned earlier, conscientious objection, which traditionally you think in terms of military exemption from military service. But increasingly we hear of conscientious objection related to people, for example, in the medical industry who don't want to be involved in any way in abortion, so they object to, on the basis of religious conscience, to giving aspirin to someone before an abortion, for example. Afterwards, it's a different matter, but these kinds of objections based on someone's religious conscience. Legal status of religious minorities, for example, the right to build a place of worship, another very hot topic in the Greek context for the mosque. And religion and education, and that's a dimension of the research that we'll be presenting today. not least because it is a very fiery topic in the Greek context. In the last several months, we've had a lot of political debates around this issue, and so we thought this would make for something particularly interesting to a Hellenic Observatory audience. But before I turn the floor to Margarita, I wanted to give you also a bit more of the background of the story and how it's set by the court's case law. And I don't know how much general knowledge to assume of how the court works, so I thought I'd just say a bit about that also. The European Court of Human Rights defends the European Convention of Human Rights on Human Rights, and that is a convention signed by 47 member states of the Council of Europe. And it sets out a number of fundamental rights to which all of these 47 member states, over 800 million people across, well beyond Europe, have these rights protected by the European Court of Human Rights, and they have each citizen has the right to take their state to court, to the European Court of Human Rights, if one of these rights is violated after they've exhausted all national judicial remedies. And once that precedent is set, it applies to the 46 other countries in the Council of Europe. So the court has made a number of landmark judgments in the area of religion and education, but I wanted to focus on one in particular that has a lot of relevance for the Greek case, and this is Folgiero versus Norway, a decision taken in 2005 or 2005, because the background of the case has a lot to do with the content of the course in religious education, and the content is something that's been debated a lot in the Greek context lately. So I'll share some details of the case. A group of parents belonging to a humanist association complained that there's in the Norwegian case a course that's compulsory in nature. The course is called Knowledge About Christianity, Religions, and Life Stances. There was a partial exemption that was available to parents, so you could choose to exempt your child from certain parts of the course, but it was a very complicated process of how to choose to understand. You had to understand the material very well in order to exempt your child. So these people complained that people should have the right to be fully exempted from the course. The Norwegian state, on its part, argued that this is a course that's developed just to help students to live in a multicultural society. It's teaching about religion, not religion itself. It's knowledge-based, it's non-confessional, which, as we most of us will know in this room, that's not the case in the Greek context. It's very much a confessional course. So the aim is to help students orient themselves competently in a multi-religious and multicultural world. But taking into account the Norwegian culture and history, there's a little bit more of an emphasis on Christianity in the course. And the Norwegian government was arguing that this is justified because of Norwegian culture and history. And the group of parents complained that the course itself violated their right to, again, the same right that we mentioned in relation to the Laozi case, the right to educate their children in relation, in reflecting their own philosophical or religious beliefs. And that the emphasis on Christianity made Christianity stand out as superior. That was their argument. So that was the main thing. Christianity standed out as superior, and that also entailed a violation of the rights. The court decided in that case in favor of this group of parents and against the Norwegian state. So we have in Folgiero a very important precedent which says basically that a religious course with such content that is emphasizing one religion over the other, even if it's knowledge-based, is in violation of the right of parents. And I want to read from it. The court declares, "It does not appear that the respondent state took sufficient care that information and knowledge included in the curriculum be conveyed in an objective, critical, and pluralistic manner." So the way religion is taught in Greek public schools would certainly not pass the Folgiero test of being critical, objective, and pluralistic in its manner. So we have precedent set, a standard against which all countries should be measuring their own religious education in their public school systems. And we have found it pretty fascinating that in the Greek context, in this fantastically intense political debate that has taken place in the last several months, amongst politicians between church and state, Folgiero was not only the elephant that was, you know, in the room, not even the elephant in the vicinity of the room, you know. This was just something that wasn't on the table in this major political debate. So Margarita is here to tell you why that's the case, amongst other things. And so I'll turn the floor to Margarita.
Okay, sure. Let me just switch this. Do you mind taking over this way so that I can...
Thanks.
Okay. F4, right?
F5.
F5. Too many logos. Sorry about that. Let me just say how happy I am to be back to this room, and thank you to Kevin Featherstone for arranging this. It's lovely to be here. So the issue of religion and education in Greece is a recurrent topic that seems to touch upon the core, upon the very foundations of church-state relations in the country, and that each government addresses in a distinctive way, often leading to political or social tensions, and widely taken up by the media as well. More than simply a matter of national concern, however, religion and education, or to be more precise, religious freedoms and education, has grown to become an issue of international concern due primarily to the different challenges out of religious pluralism in Western societies. Indicative of this trend is the growing role of the European Court of Human Rights, which has over the last 20 years dealt in different occasions with cases around religious freedoms, also in education, from the infamous Laozi case in Italy to Sahin versus Turkey and the right of a Muslim student to wear the Islamic veil when attending Turkish universities, or more recently, and you might have heard about it in the news, the Swiss case on the right of Muslim parents to have their daughter exempted from mixed-sex swimming lessons based on the argument that this practice was in violation of their religious beliefs and their principles. Greece, no wonder, has an exceptionally high record of convictions by the European Court of Human Rights over Article 9 religious freedoms-related violations. I think up until 2015 it had the highest number of violations from all Council of Europe member states. In 1993, the infamous case of Kokkinakis versus Greece opened the way to a number of petitions to the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg by marginalized communities, involving, amongst others, cases of proselytism, conscientious objection, refusal of legal personality of churches, and the authorization to build places of worship. So, in this presentation, and in line with our project, I would like to talk to you about the ways in which European Court of Human Rights decisions on religion and education have influenced domestic debates in Greece, have raised public awareness, and have provided the incentives and the opportunity structures within which citizens act and mobilize in the arena of religion and education. Conducted in the framework of Grassroots Mobilize, my presentation draws on extensive fieldwork with a range of actors in Greek society, religious minority actors, theologians, Orthodox Church representatives, lawyers and government representatives, as well as NGOs. Specifically, I shall discuss such indirect or radiating effects of the European Court of Human Rights around three debates: the content and objectives of religious education, exemption from the class of religion, and the presence of religious symbols in the school. Very briefly, let me just give you a background on the state of religion and education in Greece and why is this such a sensitive and controversial topic. The principal legal framework regulating the place of religion in education in Greece is the Constitution of 1975, with the transition to democracy. Article 3 asserts the Eastern Orthodox Church of Christ as the prevailing religion of the country. At the same time, Article 16 sets out the congruence between religion and education, which shall constitute a basic mission for the state and shall aim at the moral, intellectual, professional, and physical training of Greek citizens, the development of their national and religious conscience, and at their formation as free and responsible citizens. Now, the vagueness, to say the least, of this provision leaves room for a variety of interpretations and criticism on what the development of religious conscience, in fact, means. The critique is twofold. It targets, on the one hand, the indoctrinating character of the class of religion in Greece, whose objective is not to simply ensure students' knowledge of a specific religion or of specific religions, but rather to ensure their belonging to this very religion. Indeed, current law on education, Law 1566 of 1985, explicitly states that the class entitled Orthodox Christian Instruction should aid students to develop into free, responsible, democratic citizens in whom is instilled a faith in their motherland and in the authentic elements of Christian Orthodox tradition. In accordance with this law, the school curricula and their respective religious education textbooks adopt a predominantly mono-religious perspective. I know some of you were lucky enough to have seen this already, but I thought it hasn't changed, the books haven't changed, so I thought it's a good opportunity for me to show this again. These are the pictures in the beginning of each chapter for the third grade religious education textbook, meaning students between the ages of 9 and 10. And as you can see, the hand of Christ and the church is present in each and every occasion and instance of our lives in the countryside, in the busy life of the city. Religious education in Greek public schools is compulsory for all Christian Orthodox students in primary and secondary levels of education. Throughout the 9 years of its instruction, the content of the class is catechetical, with a disproportional emphasis on the study of Christian Orthodoxy at the expense of other religions or beliefs. Other denominational students may be granted exemption upon submitting a declaration stating that there are reasons of related to other doctrines or religious consciousness. The predominance of Christian orthodoxy is not unique to the class of religion. It rather infiltrates the entire education system, both through references to the historical links between orthodoxy and national identity spread throughout school subjects, as well as through a number of rituals that symbolize the control of the Orthodox Church over the school, such as morning prayer, the holy blessing at the start of each school year, alongside the presence of Orthodox symbols in the classrooms, to which I will come back later on. The second part of this critique touches upon the question of who is entitled to teach such a course. In Greece, religious education in high schools is taught by theologians, by Orthodox theologians, who have graduated from either of the two Orthodox faculties of Athens or Thessaloniki. Where in primary school, the main primary school teacher is in charge of also teaching religion. The fact that non-Orthodox teachers cannot teach this course, especially in primary school, often led to widespread discrimination and even to exclusion of non-Orthodox teachers from public schools. Now, two crucial developments render this discussion in Greece particularly timely. The first relates to the significant changes in the demographic setting of the country since the 1990s. This came as a result of the extended immigration influx, signifying that religious diversity in a country that claimed to be religiously homogeneous has now become a reality as much in Greek public schools as in Greek society. An interesting fact here is that Greece is amongst several EU countries that does not collect data based on the linguistic, religious, or ethnic features, characteristics of their population. So we do not really have any official data on this, and we need to rely on other forms of statistics, mainly from the Foreign Office or different kinds of sources that are offered to us. The second development concerns the recent decision by Nikos Filis, former Minister of Education of the radical left party Syriza, to reform the class of religious education, significantly altering its catechetical content. Such a decision sparked intense controversy in the media, amongst theologians, the Orthodox Church, the government of Syriza, and its coalition partner, the nationalist far-right party of Independent Greeks. And it is precisely within such a context that the Council of Europe recommendations and the European Court of Human Rights seek to offer solutions to potential challenges of religious pluralism in schools and to ensure the uniform application of the European Convention on Human Rights. But how do the messages that emanate from the court in Strasbourg blend with the specific national setting of religion and education in Greece? The debate on the content and the objectives of religious education in Greece has been taking place since roughly the mid-1990s. Some of my interviews place it even before that, with the transition to democracy, but we can come back to that later. The main concern relates to the denominational character of the subject, which fails to meet the standards set out by the Council of Europe and the Strasbourg Court for an objective, neutral, critical, and pluralistic teaching of religion. The debate takes place largely between two camps, the traditionalist side that opposes any changes to the curriculum which may challenge the place of orthodoxy in the education system, and the progressive one, which is in favor of a more open-minded and religiously neutral approach to education and religion. It is no coincidence, of course, that the terms of this discussion are dictated primarily by theologians whose very professional interests are linked to the teaching of religion in public schools. The more traditionalist side is represented by theologians who are members of or supporters of the Pan-Hellenic Union of Theologians, a scientific trade union created in 1950, which claims to bring together the majority of Orthodox theologians in the country. In 2010, some theologians broke away from this Pan-Hellenic union and created their own more progressive and smaller association named Keros. The views of these progressive theologians of Keros have materialized through the creation of the New School Project, το Νέο Σχολείο. Initiated in 2011 during the government of the Pan-Hellenic Social Movement, PASOK, by then Minister of Education, Anna Diamandopoulou, this project entails a series of proposals for the improvement of the curriculum and the educational orientations of various school subjects, amongst which that of religion. Now, whether and how this program will eventually replace the long-standing approach to religious education is an extremely timely matter in Greece. Since 2011, with the exception of very few voices within the parliament, the question on the implementation of the new school program for religious education had remained in abeyance. It only returned to the forefront following the electoral victory of Syriza on January 2015, and even more intensely after the second consecutive victory of Syriza in the elections of the same year, September 2015. Thus, as Nikos Filis, former Minister of Education, repeatedly stated the necessity to reform the class of religion on the basis of the new school, and even proceeded to, let's say, a partial implementation of the new school program, national actors positioned themselves publicly and fervently on either side of the debate. The actors interviewed indicate that this debate takes place in a national context under specific conditions that are unique solely to Greece. Education in Greece falls in the category of what Helen Wallace has famously described as national protected spaces, which European norms find particularly hard to influence, to permeate. Indeed, theologians in Greece rarely allude to the court in Strasbourg, which they see as lacking authority to intervene in such sensitive domestic affairs. For instance, a progressive theologian, who is based at the Institute of Education Policy of the Ministry of Education, explained to me how each decision reached by the court, and I quote, relates to a specific subcontext, either philosophical, ideological, historical, or political. It is precisely for this reason why, in his view, a given decision by the court does not necessarily apply to other countries or to other cases. This, however, does not signify that Europe features in the same ways or to the same degree in actors' arguments and mobilizations around the content of religious education. Rather, I argue that the court's jurisprudence has created a vague yet important point of reference to which actors in Greece varyingly refer according to their different objectives, their levels of awareness, and their resources. Traditionalist theologians in Greece tend to be comparatively even more skeptical towards the European Court of Human Rights. They seem to largely equate interventions from abroad with a betrayal of orthodoxy from within the country. Their concern with the new school is that they consider it a threat to the religious tradition of national identity of young people in Greece. And their main weapon to oppose any changes is constant recourse to the articles of the Constitution I mentioned earlier, which, as they claim, leave little room for doubt over the place that religion does and should have in education. A key actor belonging in the traditionalist circle of theologians talked to me about the ways in which the Constitution is given precedence over all other types of authority, but moreover about how he believes the Greek Constitution is itself in line with European Court of Human Rights case law. It's a long quote, but bear with me, it's interesting. As the Constitution asserts, one of the objectives of education is the development of religious consciousness of students, which means that we should teach students about their own faith. The way things are now, students are being taught about religions in a descriptive, informative, and neutral manner. To do otherwise means to proselytize. It means lack of respect of the Constitution and of the European Court of Human Rights, since you're not respecting someone else's religion. What this new program does, meaning the new school, is to brainwash 8-year-old children. They're asking us to punish our children by forcing them to learn about 9 different religions. Now, this is definitely respect of one's freedom to education. Now, in the light of the current and the ongoing economic crisis, and in line with accusations also by the current government against the various impositions by Greece's European partners, very often this debate on religious education is seen as yet another influence from abroad. For instance, the Orthodox Church's Archbishop of Athens and the whole of Greece, Hieronymus, has repeatedly taken a stance on this. He interprets any discussions within the country to change religious education as impositions from Europe. It seems that in this case as well, our European friends take advantage of our dire economic situation, and within the wider context of regulations of our financial agreements, they seek to distort Greek society in any possible way, starting with our school education. More recently, that was in 2015, Hieronymus has directly attacked former Minister Philis following the latter's decision to proceed to the implementation of the new school for religious education. In fact, Philis's attempt to reform the class has triggered a much wider and fierce debate over the question of church-state relations in the country, with Archbishop Hieronymus accusing the Syriza administration of using a progressive guise to promote, and I quote, an intolerant, anti-religious, and anti-clerical populist spirit to push for church-state separation. Apart from theologians and the different voices in the Orthodox Church, because this is just an example of some of the voices from the Orthodox Church, the different religious minority communities in Greece also express their views on the matter. But in their mobilizations and their religious rights claims, the question of religious education does not figure amongst their priorities. Though they do realize the preferential treatment of Christian orthodoxy in the Greek schools, to their eyes, the possibility of exemption from the class of religion forms a convenient, though not always an easy, solution. In theory, every student in Greece has a right to ask for an exemption from the specific class through a declaration indicating that there are reasons related to other doctrines, religion, or religious consciousness. However, and this brings us to our following topic, this option appears to be available exclusively to non-Orthodox students. So the rules underpinning except the process of exemption in Greece are set by government circulars, which have changed very frequently over the last few years. The current circular, issued just days before Syriza's electoral victory in January 2015, specifies that non-Orthodox students are given the possibility of exemption, invoking reasons of religious conscience. The controversy, however, emerges specifically through the following paragraphs of the circular, which introduce certain conditions for exemption. As on some occasions over the last years, an exploitation of the right to exemption related to freedom of religious conscience has been observed, school directors are asked to inspect the validity of the reasons presented. The formal declaration should state that the student is not Christian Orthodox and has thus the right to claim reasons of religious conscience without the obligatory reference to his religion unless he or she, no, just he, it's from Greek, so it's just he, he so wishes. This circular reflects a very important concern amongst theologians in the country, namely the growing tendency of students to ask for exemption by evoking reasons of religious conscience so that they have one less subject to study. Therefore, and as most of my interviews emphasize, this particular issue does not concern non-Orthodox students so much, who do have a right to be granted exemption, but rather those Orthodox students, or those who have been baptized as Orthodox, and we can come back to this in the discussion, who wish to be offered the same option, not to attend the class. At the same time, the requirements listed in this circular, still in force, have given rise to debates regarding the rights of the child and the disclosure of personal information. Now, recently, the specific aspect of religious education was brought back to the fore following yet again statements by officials of the Syriza government. Only days after Syriza's second victory, Sia Anagnostopoulou, the newly appointed alternate Minister of Education, announced her intention to simplify the exemption process. She added, moreover, that parents should be allowed to simply ask that their child does not take the class of religion with no reference, either positive or negative, to their religion. Following reactions by Archbishop Hieronymos, and though Anagnostopoulou has since toned down or even revoked her initial statements, they tend to do that a lot, such statements were enough to spark another debate. And as with the content and the objectives of religious education, however, the political opportunity structure was provided for actors to mobilize towards the realization of their claims in relation this time to exemption. Now, as atheist holders, the European Court of Human Rights has dealt with the question of exemption in very similar cases. Infogera versus Norway, I will go through this very quickly for those of you who weren't here. The applicants, who were members of the Norwegian Humanist Association, submitted to the court that the religious class in Norway was neither objective, nor critical, nor pluralistic, and that a core purpose of the class was to strengthen the pupils' own Christian foundations, which violated their right to have their children taught and raised according to their own beliefs. Indeed, the European Court of Human Rights held that Christianity accounted for about half of the material in religious education curriculum in Norway, with other beliefs only marginally represented. Similarly, another case in which the court has dealt with the issue of exemption and the content of religious education is Zengin versus Turkey, which concerned the refusal to exempt a state school pupil whose family was of the Alevi faith from mandatory lessons on religion and morals in Turkey, which is heavily, if not exclusively, based on Sunni Islam. Yet, in spite of the pertinence of these cases with the issue at stake in Greece, the court in Strasbourg does not seem to shape the terms of the domestic debate. The one actor who did refer to Folgero versus Norway, though not by name, engages with issues to do with religious education at the Ministry of Education. He explained to me that, and I quote, according to the Rome Protocol, parents can intervene in their children's education if it is not in conformity with their own beliefs. And he pointed out, however, that the Norwegian example shows us that one has to justify the reasons for asking for exemption. He further believes that the implementation of the new school project will render the question of exemption irrelevant altogether, which is some bit problematic. In general, grassroots actors in Greece are primarily interested in the role of national legal authorities in the matter, while the court in Strasbourg remains on the sidelines. There is, however, one exception. The one actor that seems to mobilize, drawing inspiration, amongst others, from the European Court of Human Rights, is the recently emerging atheist movement, represented primarily by the Atheist Union. This is a page from their website. This particular group of actors seeks to take advantage of the political opportunity structures offered to them as they consider, or used to consider, because I spoke to them since, the current government a potential alliance partner. Nonetheless, the symbolic importance of the Syriza government even opening the discussion to such issue is, to their eyes, very important in itself. The union's primary objective is the abolition of the class of religion altogether, and in the likely case that this does not happen, offering the possibility of exemption from the class to all students. Now, basing themselves to a great extent on the rulings of the European Court of Human Rights, the members of the Atheist Union set their agenda and turned for support to national legal authorities, and more specifically to the Hellenic Data Protection Authority, an independent body whose decisions are binding. This recourse to the Hellenic Data Protection Authority is connected with the case of a mother, there's always a mother apparently, who had decided to take the case of her child who was denied exemption in primary school, in a Greek primary school, to national courts, to the Greek Ombudsman Office in Athens. In such a legal struggle, the possibility of reaching Strasbourg seemed like a desirable yet a very distant target for the atheist union. Their main concern in such a prospect had to do both with the delay caused the condition of having to exhaust all national remedies before reaching Strasbourg, and of course with the question of financial resources. Eventually, in a decision that is largely understood as a means to maintain a certain balance in church-state relations, the Hellenic Data Protection Authority found that the current procedure of exemption, the current circular, does not run the risk of the negative disclosure of students' personal information, meaning the right not to have to declare which religion you do not belong to. In spite of the Hellenic Data Protection Authority's decision, however, the debate is open and ongoing. Now, as mentioned earlier, the omnipresence of Christian Orthodoxy in the Greek school is further guaranteed through the presence of religious symbols, most often icons in the classroom depicting Jesus Christ or the Virgin Mary. This is a typical photo of a typical classroom public school in Greece. It is thus no coincidence that, perhaps with the exception of Kokkinakis, no other European Court of Human Rights case was evoked in my interviews as frequently as Laozi versus Italy. Now, you talked about it extensively. There were two decisions by the court in Laozi. The first one was in favor of Mrs. Laozi's complaint. The second one, by the court, overturned the prior decision, stating that, in principle, it is not for the court to rule on such questions, as the solutions may legitimately vary according to the country and to the year. Now, although the crucifix was above all other meanings a religious symbol, the Grand Chamber found no evidence that the display of such a symbol might have an influence on pupils. The court finally considered that the crucifix was a rather passive symbol, as opposed to the active teaching on a certain religion or the forced participation of students in religious activities. I don't know if that rings a bell. So the interpretation and usages of Laozi versus Italy in Greece vary depending on a number of factors. The indirect effects, as a matter of fact, of Laozi in the Greek context are an indicative example of how a single judicial action, a single decision by the court, may radiate different messages to different audiences. The traditionalist view in Greece is rather pleased with the final ruling of the court and raises the, in its view, rather rhetorical question, does the presence of religious icons really harm our society? Is that what the problem is? The one aspect that either explicitly or implicitly emerged in all my discussions with national actors relevant to Laozi was the principle of the margin of appreciation. In practice, this legal doctrine means that in cases where the court considers that there's no consensus in international law, it decides to allow a degree of autonomy to national authorities, which are seen as better suited to decide how to protect the individual rights provided in the convention. The ways in which the European Court of Human Rights has used this doctrine of the margin of appreciation, especially in areas such as religious freedoms, is in fact one of the most controversial aspects of its jurisprudence. So in the Greek context, the case of Laozi, and in particular the principle of the margin of appreciation and the lack of intervention by the court, are interpreted as a means that justifies the choices of the state when it comes to matters of religious manifestation in the school, and not only. Such a view is reflected through the arguments of a conservative theologian who significantly minimizes the overall impact of the court. What do these international human rights courts say? That each country is free to do as it wishes. That's not what they say, of course. Yes, this case was about the religious icons, not symbols, he said icons, so he Hellenized it, in Italy by the mother of a student who wasn't even Italian herself. She was half Italian, half
Finnish.
But the second decision by the court stated that this practice of religious icons is tradition, a part of history that has influenced everything. Certain more progressive theologians and education experts believe that the intertwining of Christian Orthodoxy in education in Greece leads to a fundamentally indoctrinating type of national education system. Accordingly, if Laozi were to be hypothetically placed within a Greek context, say if a mother complained to the court in Strasbourg about the presence of the religious icons in the public school, the indoctrinating teaching of religious education would have led to a different decision by the court in Strasbourg involving Greece's conviction and the request to remove symbols from classrooms. As a progressive theologian observed, the court could not have reached the same verdict in Greece. The entire class of religious education would have to be abolished. At some point, things will change. In perhaps 5 or 10 years from now, Greek society has changed. It has been forced to change. But religions are trapped in their own mindset, and they pull the state towards their direction, since politicians are afraid of the political cost of their actions. So, to conclude, I tried to show to you today that the court's influence, the court's case law, the influence of the court's case law on religion and education in Greece is limited due to three overall reasons, as I see it. The first has to do with a particular understanding of the doctrine of the margin of appreciation, which is in fact not unique to the case of Greece. This is a problem that is potentially inherent to the way the European Court of Human Rights functions. This understanding of the doctrine of the margin of appreciation is strongly linked to strategic references to and varying interpretations of the court's judgments, meaning that European Court of Human Rights case law is seen as malleable depending on the respective actors' objectives and their levels of awareness. The third reason has to do with an embedded culture of constitutionality in Greece and the perception by a majority of actors in the field of education and religion, and not only, that the constitution is a rigid and established framework whose laws regulating religion education leave little space for maneuvering over any kind of changes in this field. Now, this is rather pessimistic, but this is not to say that the European Court of Human Rights does not figure in mobilizations around religion and education in the country. The court has created an opportunity space within which national actors may gain awareness about their rights, form opinions on different matters, and even mobilize, be it in national courts or potentially at some point even before the Strasbourg court. And this is reflected primarily through the atheist movement, which has sought to use the Strasbourg court for the framing of their claims in legal terms and the setting of their agenda to mobilize before national authorities, as well as in the media. Another, finally, dimension of this process of mobilization are the political and social changes that may affect the place of religion in the education system. Now, though the recent controversy between the former Minister of Education, the Archbishop, and Syriza's coalition partner over the new program for religious education did end with the government's, Syriza's, retreat, even defeat, and the eventual dismissal of Philis from his position following a government reshuffle, national actors in Greece seem to share the view that changes have occurred in the country, in which the court in Strasbourg plays its own role, interacting with national tradition, laws, and practices. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. That gave us lots to think about. I know there are going to be quite a few questions. I'm just going to ask quickly a couple of, factual things. One has to do with the rulings against Greece, because you talk quite a bit about the other sort of example-setting cases, right? But I wonder if you could say a bit more about the effect of rulings that have happened against Greece in the Court of Human Rights. You mentioned one or two, but I'd be interested to hear a bit more about the effects of those. And also, I wondered a bit more about the cases in your project. I mean, how this, if you could say something perhaps about the wider comparison, because I know that FEU had a project that was more specifically on and national identity and religion, right? Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of comparisons to be made with Turkey, for example, and the way, as you said, you know, in schools, the prevalence of Sunni Sunni Muslim education, but also just the way that national identity and religion are so inextricably intertwined, and people can't imagine being Greek and not being Orthodox, or being Turkish and not being Muslim, right? So I wondered also about the other cases that are involved in this, and if there's something similar going on there, or how that equation or non-equation might affect things differently in those other cases.
Would you want to take the first question, I the second?
Yes, more than
yeah.
There haven't been any cases from Greece reaching Strasbourg concerning religious... My voice is gone, sorry.
Okay.
concerning religious education or anything to do... Well, actually, there has been with Jehovah's Witnesses, but that had to do with participation in parades, in military parades, which Jehovah's Witnesses students did not... What was, again, was a violation of their own pacifist principles. But there haven't been any specific cases related to religion education in Greece, from Greece, which is a big surprise to us. But there are actors from Greece who wish to take, mainly from the secularist and atheist movements, who wish to someday take especially the exemption issue to the court in Strasbourg. The case of the mother I mentioned very briefly was one of them, but it was resolved finally. Now, about the other cases, like I said, Greece has the highest number of convictions. Most of these cases were petitioned by Jehovah's Witnesses, and in fact, the first ever ruling, the first ever conviction by a state on Article 9, religious freedom-related issue, was against Greece and the right to proselytism, which is prohibited by the Greek constitution, was Kokkinakis versus Greece in 1993, which... formed the foundation of the court's jurisprudence in Article 9 cases. There have been many cases related to the legal challenges of religious minorities, build the right to build and establish and run places of worship. The case of the mosque has not been taken to the court either, because Athens is doesn't have an official... Well, we'll soon have, hopefully, a mosque, but up until now it didn't have an official mosque. Conscientious objection, a very recent ruling as well, conscientious objection related to military service, which is also the case in Turkey, so this is something we're studying in parallel.
I think one of the really interesting findings in Margarita's research has been that certainly you can see very clearly that the case law to do with Jehovah's Witnesses has made the life of Jehovah's Witnesses much easier, and other religious groups look to the Jehovah's Witnesses for advice and for, they try to model themselves after Jehovah's Witnesses in terms of how they can mobilize legally. So I think that those cases, particularly Kokkinakis, but several other cases won by the Jehovah's Witnesses afterwards, have communicated a very strong message that, okay, we're willing to take this to the court, we will win, and other religious groups then are... emboldened in their claims.
And they seek advice from Jehovah's Witnesses.
The last time I presented here into this context, it was about, and this starts to respond to your other question, about limitations to religious freedoms in majority Orthodox contexts. And Greece has over 20% of violations. It's one country out of the 47, over 20% of violations of religious freedom. So it's striking that this... problems continue to arise, and like Margarita said, such an issue that it's clear that the Greek state would lose if someone were to take the case of religious education to the court, and yet it hasn't. I think it's largely also personal. It's difficult for families that have started processes, and it's kind of difficult to put your child through the whole legal process because you have to have as a plaintiff. Anyway, the about the selection of cases, so I have two majority Orthodox countries, one majority Muslim country, and one majority Catholic. And the majority Orthodox has to do with the fact that it's not like Greece has over 20% of the violations of Article 9, but majority Orthodox countries also together represent over 63% of violations of Article 9. And they're not that many in the amongst the 47 countries, so it's really a disproportionate number of violations of religious freedom. So I felt that there needed to be more research on what is going on in majority Orthodox countries, why these problems arise. And I wanted to have a comparison with the Turkish case because the court is very controversial in its handling of Islam. So, for example, the court, Margarita mentioned, determined in the reversal of the original Lausi decision that the cross, the crucifix, is a passive religious symbol, and yet it is consistently approved of bans of the headscarf in schools
and in public spaces.
And in public spaces now, in the SAS case in France. as an active religious symbol. So why is the one active? And it didn't matter whether it was the teacher or students as well. The court supports a ban on the headscarf in general. So that's a really interesting kind of comparison to be able to make. And something that's been fascinating in the Italian case, because of Lao Tzu, it's such an important case. But one of the fascinating results in comparison across the cases has been to see the difference between the cases in terms of their relationship with the European Union and when they joined the EU, or whether they have joined the EU. And in the Turkish and the Romanian cases, the court has got a tremendous importance in the national level case law. Mm-hmm. Judges in Romania are...
gain credits.
Yeah, they gain credits. They're promoted based on how much they cite the European Court of Human Rights. Mm-hmm. So this is, and prosecutors as well. And so this makes a tremendous difference in how applicable the court's case law can be at the national level in the Romanian case, for example. And in the Turkish case, this is kind of the extent to which the Turkish courts refer to the European Court of Human Rights kind of varies with the relationship that the country is having with the EU and whether there's an active chasing of membership or not. Mm-hmm. And so this varies in a really interesting way as well.
Okay, makes sense. Thank you. Well, let's open the floor for questions. And would everyone please say their name and perhaps affiliation if you have one? Yeah. Anna.
Yeah. Anna Titova from the LSC. I just want to stay to the last slide that Margarita showed. Don't you think that it's perfectly understandable to have that the European Court of Human Rights has had limited influence? Because the doctrine of the margin of appreciation, whenever it's applied in sensitive cases, it brings these kinds of results. So for my PhD research, they did the same thing in national security issues. Mm-hmm. My current research, they're doing the same thing with social rights litigation in terms of austerity measures. So. Don't you think that this has to do with the institutional role of the court, which is a supranational court? It is not a national or a European court. And as such, it sort of has to show deference to national decisions. And this also relates to your second point, the Bahrain strategic references. Yes, it would be strategic because of the sensitivity of the matters and because of the institutional position of the court.
Mm-hmm. Should I respond or should I?
Let's see if there are any other questions. We could take one or two more.
I think that what is interesting, you're absolutely right in what you're saying. I think that what is interesting, though, is the way national actors perceive of this doctrine. They perceive it as a doctrine that allows them to pretty much do whatever it is they want to do, which is not what the court is trying to put forward at all. So in this case, this goes back to what I was saying about a case similar to Lauti reaching Strasbourg from Greece, meaning that would the margin of appreciation then apply the case of Greece? Would the court still consider that this is an area very national, very sensitive topic to which it cannot intervene and therefore takes recourse to the margin of appreciation? This is the idea that these are, if you like, the radiating messages that such a doctrine as the margin of appreciation radiates to national actors, to people who may actually mobilize within the country. So whereas legally what you're saying, I'm assuming, is absolutely correct, and this is why I like your feedback so much, because I'm not a legal scholar, socially and politically, these are the effects of the margin of appreciation. This is what further limits the influence of the court's case law on a national setting.
And also, a bit of follow-up, let us not forget that the court takes into account the changing trends
absolutely.
In culture.
Absolutely.
And they have done this in other policy areas.
Yeah.
So maybe same-sex marriage may not have been considered legal 10 years ago, but then after the Vanhanathos case, it's now considered legal because out of 47 member states, I don't know how many have already approved this. So let's also take into account the sensitivity of the matter, but also the change in trends.
The consensus among the
member states of the Council of Europe.
Absolutely, you're right. The same-sex civil unions is another topic we have been studying, and Vallenatos was largely a result of this consensus, this sort of majority of Council of Europe member states having applied some form of recognition to same-sex couples, and Greece was an exception to that, hence the conviction of the country for same-sex civil unions. Same-sex civil marriage is pending. We'll see.
Any other questions? Okay, one at the back and then Dali.
By comparison outside Europe between Lebanon and Greece, I got from your talk that state and church in Greece are intertwined in matters of religious education.
Yeah.
By comparison, in Lebanon, the state is neutral, therefore absence of religious symbols in state schools. But state schools are not preferred for middle class and people of means. So it's left only for the poor and people who, you know, despite that, it depends where your school is. If it's in a majority Christian area, that means it's more likely the Muslims there wouldn't get, they have the right of exception, as you say.
Okay.
But also the same thing for Christian, but they feel under pressure, social pressure, both communities. So my question here about two points, about private schools in Greece, whether they are Muslim or Christian or whatever, does the law apply to them? And number two, in matters of religious holidays in Lebanon, because of the state is weak, so it left the sects to dictate their own ways, and then we have the biggest number of religious holidays in the world. So in this case, to respect everyone, when the state, you know, even for every sect, Shia, Sunni, Druze, whatever, and for Catholics, even we have like an Easter, when you have like 5 days of rain, you have, this is for Greek Orthodox, kind of rain, and this for Maronitic Catholic period of rain. So you see what I mean? It's in the folklore and the religious education, but my question is about the schools and the holidays, the private schools. Thank you.
Take one more.
Hello, Thalia Majorou, Hellenic Observatory. I come from psychology, so I can't ask a legal question, but I was wondering, and I will try to be provocative, if we could consider comparing, for example, France to Greece, where I have an experience living there, if in the case of France, laïcité is the state's position main, I don't know, something that the children are supposed to learn, I guess, when they go to the public schools. And if we consider that for now a sort of mixture of religion with state is the case in Greece, would it be interesting to look at specific cases, for example, as you say, how same-sex marriage or unions are treated in each case, how Darwin's theory about species is
taught.
Because maybe, for example, I don't know if it's, but the presence of symbols is very important, but exceptions from different positions could be asked with the reasoning of I belong to this group or my religion, or I consider that this is the right way to do things. A question came out. My question would be, for example, would you have, if we don't consider that there is a right way to do things in the state, if you go to something that is proven, like scientific theory of, or the possibility to live the way you want, would religions go to, different religions or groups would go to the European court to ask for exceptions because they are not satisfied, and in the case of France and Greece.
Okay. be able to address those questions.
So thank you very much. I didn't know that about Lebanon. Thank you both of you. I didn't know that about and the extended holidays. So private schools in Greece, usually they apply the exact same program as public schools. There are some few private schools that put an emphasis on Christian Orthodoxy, and they're usually named after a certain Orthodox saint. But the program they follow is pretty much the same as in public schools, hence the same teaching of religious education. And I have to say here, which I failed to mention in my presentation, that eventually, and this is why it is hard to generalize, how religious education is going to be taught depends on the theologian in charge. So you might be in a very conservative school, even in a very conservative religious school, but the theologian might be very open-minded and approach sort of a phenomenological approach to religion or a pluralistic approach to religion. There are two exceptions, actually just one big exception in Greece, which is a part in the northern part of the country, in western Thrace, it's in the borders with Turkey. There's a very large minority, Muslim minority there, which had remained there following the exchange of population between Greece and Turkey in 1923, and where the specific system of education is entirely different from what is happening in the rest of the country. They're not being taught orthodoxy, religious education at all. They're being taught the focus on Islam, since most of the students are Muslim over there. And there used to be as well a Catholic, which island was it on?
Sidos.
In Sidos, I think, where there was a large majority of Catholics on the island of Sidos. Because there was a large enough number of students there to be able to ask for a specific kind of teaching, non-Orthodox teaching of religion, and they had a Catholic teaching of religion, but this is no longer the case, I think. It has been a few years now. And the holidays is Christian Orthodox holidays, just Christian Orthodox holidays, not just for the schools, but any public institution. Now, as for France, that was actually the topic of my PhD. I was comparing France and Greece as two fascinating extremes, if you like, in the European spectrum of church-state relations and their approaches to education. Now, if I understood your question, I think that I don't know of whether any cases concerning, for instance, the teaching of biology or of evolution have reached the court in Strasbourg. Maybe the Supreme Court in the States.
I think there was a case. We have a lot of research in the project so far that's been fascinating on this topic. No, nothing has reached the European Court of Human Rights, but it's certainly coming close to reaching national level. There's gender theory teaching in the Italian case, and evolution, the way that evolution is taught or not taught across the countries. Definitely religion infiltrates lots of courses. In the Greek context, in the history course, it's very obvious.
Yeah.
But in other countries as well. So it's very much an aspect of our data that we're gathering, but I think it's something that we'll see probably in the future in the European Court of Human Rights, not yet.
That's interesting. You're ahead.
I'd like to add something off to the previous question, though, about private schools. As a user, as a mother who interviewed lots of school administrators about this, because it became part of my research, not only for my children's schools, but also I was very curious, like, how do they handle religion? It's fascinating. They are, obviously, as Margarita said, they follow the same curriculum. So the school books are the same, the texts are the same. And as Margarita also said, each theologian has a lot of leeway in how exactly the course is going to be taught. And you see a major difference. But in all the private schools that I visited and then asked other parents about as well, because, like I said, it became an interesting research project, there's always some form of school prayer, and that's optional. There's also usually a process of taking the children to church to take communion. And these are optional, and I'll ask, and I've asked several directors, why do you choose this option? And they say it reflects Greek society. Most parents want this. And so it's interesting. I've also presented statistics about actually what parents want, because there have been some interesting surveys, one of the recent surveys that we saw circulate, that we just on a lot of it, questions to do with religion, and showing that there is a very low percentage of Greek population actually attending church. So are you sure that the parents actually want their children going to church? I was just curious what they would say, and they would say yes, and it's, you know, goes to what Grace says about vicarious religion. They would like the church to be there. They like the school to kind of communicate this message, but they're not going to be the ones taking their children to church. So, yeah, it's still, by and large, the policies followed by the schools, although they're not required to.
Just to add something to this, yes, this is absolutely the case, and very often parents are afraid that their children are going to be stigmatized if they do not also take the class of religion, or they do not go to church with the majority of children. So in the microcosm of the school, this is also very often a possibility that the parents fail.
Okay, let me do it this way. One, two, and three. That's what I think.
My example is from London. I just want to comment on something. I mean, we have taken into account in Greece two things. First of all, it takes a long time to give justice. So the case against the court is not 8 years. And the second thing we have taken into account is the fact that every minister of national Greece education sort of changes, even the case of exemption. So by the time you take a case to the court, which is going to take 10 years, appealing to the Supreme Court and then the European Court of Human Rights, then that ruling of exemption of the class might change a few times, or it actually might be totally in 10 years' time. So, and then in terms of being exempt from the class, the religious class, you can first of all stop to give a reason of why you want to be exempted, and the reason is usually religion. You can't say it because you could be equally Greek Orthodox, but you simply don't want to attend the class because you don't want to. So, personally, I would be against exemption. So you either make the religious course like a selective course where students can take it. Mm. Otherwise, when you have five people not attending the class, everybody's going to point them out, and they're going to question why they haven't been attending the class. Are they Muslim? Are they atheists? Or what's wrong there? I think we have to take into account, and from my last comment, from my personal experience, because when I was in middle school, we had a priest in school teaching this course, and which was a bit shocking for me. And I was an atheist back then, and when I was a child, but I wanted to be a bit provocative to the priest in our class, and I asked him, how do we know God is real, and why could it not be that Buddhism is the right religion, and who is the right God, basically. And he said, have you read, about Buddhism? It's basically a joke, if you read about it. And that's how it sort of stopped the discussion. That's like when we never had any religion or any education about other matters.
I'm Katerina Dinyanaki from the LSE. I just read last week an interesting article about a petition being put together and being circulated right now in Greece from religious and conservative parents that they want their kids to be exempt from the newly introduced class of gender theory and sexuality because they don't want their kids to think it's okay to be gay or to be intersex, whatever. So I was wondering, I'm so fresh right now, but it would be interesting to see a comparison of how these kind of petitions are treated compared to petitions from atheist parents.
From atheist parents,
Thank you, and thank you for your presentation. It's very illuminating, certainly. I'm not a good speaker. My question would be really along the lines of definition of a lot of sort of words that were being thrown around, like orthodox, like a theologian, that I will take as it were court. I have one sort of specific technical question. Whether in your research you did any interviews with different, it actually follows the point that you made about the changing environment, interviews with people of different generations on this very subject. I think the generation of parents nowadays who have children, specifically in primary school, is one case, they say so. The generation of, say, my parents, you know, people born in the beginning of the 19th century or the 20th century, may have another opinion. I think this would be very illuminating because actually it will show you why and how things may change, how even the arguments may come up. But my main question, and it's a bit of a cheeky one, if I may say so, I think it arises from these assumptions that have been made, and it's part of the tension between the state and church relation. When it exists in places, or rather the established churches in places like Britain, where we live, or Greece, or emerging countries like Romania, is becoming effectively an established church, never mind Russia, never mind other countries, some of the Scandinavian ones, Sweden, Finland, have established churches. Now, the problem there is that, and I'm often in my kind of dreams, fantasize how I could bring up a case to the court of being forced by a parent to baptize that child, or being forced effectively. By forced, of course, it isn't a physical force, but it's a kind of emotional, psychological, call it religious force exercised on their part to marry couples. And last of all, perhaps the most poignant for most cases, I think, is to pray or say prayers at the end of life. All these things that are assumed, you see, were on the part of people who could claim to be religious, whatever background, who literally impose upon practitioners of religion their views. And we, if I may sort of say so, often have no recourse, other perhaps you're giving me ideas to go to the court. I do not wish to have this being done to me. Never mind the teaching of, because all of this, it's the assumption that are behind it, how parents assume, and the stigma that you mentioned is part of it. So I just wonder whether you have any ideas about how the opposite tide, or the return of the tide, might take place. And as I said, in particular, whether you did any research with the different generation.
Thank you, Alexander, very much. Everything you said is correct. The delay within the national legal system of Greece, and not just Greece, many countries, very often discourages national actors who wish to take their case and appeal to the court in Strasbourg, because it's not just the delay, it's also the money, the financial resources, and the having to expose oneself and one's personal convictions in public. Now, what you said about your experience with a priest, a theologian, that was teaching a course of religious education, I think that something's very interesting here is that theologians in Greece, in the majority of cases, in most cases, are not aware of how to teach about other religions. So I attended a training seminar for members of Keros, this sort of more progressive association of theologians, back in December in Thessaloniki. And there were theologians there. One of them was teaching in a multicultural high school in Thessaloniki, and all she had was immigrant refugee students who claimed they were 16 years old. They were actually adults, but claimed they were underage so that they could gain the status of refugee and remain in the country. And they were all of Islamic faith, and they will attend her class. And she had absolutely no idea how to approach them and what to tell them. She was completely lost. She was scared both pedagogically and content-wise. She knew very little about how to talk about other religions, specifically about Islam. So this is an inherent problem, and this is why the theologians are the ones who react so much when it comes to any kind of transformation of religious education, even though the new school program is a rather mild one. It's very progressive compared to the previous one, judging from the pictures I've shown to you. But it is not exactly that open-minded. It still has the focus on Christian Orthodoxy. It's still Orthodox theologians who have graduated from the two faculties of theology who will be teaching it, and who themselves need to be taught about how to teach religions. So it's a very complicated matter. So it's not just the student and the teacher in the classroom. It's also the teacher himself or herself who needs to prepare for this. Now, what was it? The atheist. I think this is fascinating. You took a note of this.
Yeah.
We could look into it further. Thank you very much. This is a fascinating idea. Interestingly enough, thank you very much for your comments and your question. I have interviewed theologians and parents and national actors in general of different ages, from different generations. And it is not always the case that the eldest ones are the most conservative ones, bizarrely enough. I found some very passionate conservative theologians who are very much against, for instance, this kind of reform of the New School project in the current state of affairs, whereas some older ones, what do I mean by older ones? They were older compared to the specific theologian I'm referring to, were much more open-minded and willing to push forward for reform. Now, about you being, practitioners being forced to baptize, you know, as you very well know, in Greece, these kinds of rituals are part of a tradition. Same with religious marriage and baptism and attending a class of religious education is something like a ritual, a tradition that a Greek citizen as a Christian Orthodox has to go through because this is the way it's being done. So I'm not sure whether and in how many cases Greek Orthodox practitioners feel themselves being forced to do something like this, to baptize someone, even though that person might not be religious at all.
The majority.
In
silence.
In silence, okay. Well, yeah.
I'd like to.
Cases where they refuse to baptize a child because the parents had a political marriage.
Mm. Oh, true, absolutely, you're right. Yeah. Or have had a divorce.
Mm. That's a completely different issue.
Yeah.
Can I add to those questions also just briefly? I'd go backwards, Paul Alexander. Thank you for sharing your thoughts and dreams. and I hate to ruin them for you, but the court has set really good, I don't mean good as in a normative sense, but very strong precedents on this topic. And it shows a respect for the religious autonomy of religious groups, and so you would have very little chance of fighting the Orthodox Church in forcing you to do anything that you didn't want to do. The most important recent case is in a Romanian case. A group of clerics wanted to form a union, and the court ruled that the Orthodox Church has the right to tell them that you can't unionize within the Orthodox Church. And this is actually an influence that's coming from the U.S. very much on. There are a lot of U.S.-based lawyers who were supporting that case, supporting the Romanian Orthodox Church, because they don't want precedent set in Europe to support the idea that, you would lose, but that's a really that's an important dimension to be taken into consideration. It's a sad fact of the story. Generational, we haven't taken ever a generational approach, and that's also a good suggestion, but I should point out our research is not about people's feelings on these topics. It's specifically about the extent to which they would look at the court and use the court's case law to try to gain new rights, or they'd be discouraged by the court's case law. So that would have an important generational dimension, how much awareness, how much exposure they would have had to the court. That's something. So it's a good suggestion. Thank you for making it. About gender theory, you had asked. I think it's important also to say that, it tends to be more atheist groups and secularist groups that refer to the court and mobilize on the basis of the European Court of Human Rights or legal action in general. It's counter-mobilization that we see in religious groups, and so it's kind of it's a reaction, not a direct action. Generally, that's what we've seen across the cases. And finally to Alexander, just to say about the length of the judicial process. I don't think in many other countries we have such frequent changes in the laws on these issues. I mean, it's like you say, every change of government we have new circulars on exemption. But exemption happens to be a really a big problem across almost all the cases, beyond the ones that we're studying also. I don't think any country has come up with a fantastic solution to this problem, because kids are ostracized when they're... on whatever basis they choose to avoid the class. So it's, we don't have really good practice as an example set across cases for that.
We have just one last question. I'll have to ask you to make it a short one. That's okay. Yes, yeah.
Two factual questions. One is, what is the current state of play in terms of who can teach a religious education class other than theologians? I know that you have to be Orthodox. But what about the idea of having historians who are trained in religion to teach a religious education class? And second, is there any discussion, any debate about what you do with the growing number of students who are asking for exemptions? What is the alternative for them other than just sit and do nothing and play in the courtyard?
These are both questions for you. The Greek case study.
Thank you, Lina. No, there has not been any kind of discussion around the possibility of having someone, a non-theologian, teaching the class of religious education in Greece. There has been in other countries, of course, but not in Greece. Even with the new program, it is exclusively for theologians who are meant to adapt to it and to learn how to teach it. And the second one, to my knowledge, no, there have been no talks about offering some kind of an alternative to students who are granted exemption. And this is a huge issue, because those students either sit in class and listen or go outside, and very often nobody's where, especially in primary school, nobody's there to watch over them. Yeah, they're all over the place. And there has been a case, I think, in Rhodes, was it, where a Muslim student in primary school had asked for exemption and did not take the class, and he got himself hurt while playing in his own the courtyard. But that didn't create a precedent. That didn't. And it's strange that you mention it. I haven't heard anything about it. Yeah.
Can you allow me just to make one little footnote? May I suggest that you do not use the word theologian to describe these people? This is a good point. They're simply graduates of the schools of theology.
Right, right.
Many
right.
of them, they're not
right.
even Christians, many of them declare they do not wish to be
sure.
believers. So they're simply graduates of theological
sure.
school.
Sure.
I think that's an important, certainly when we use this word in English, theologian is something
okay.
else. Someone who studies psychology is not automatically a psychologist. Someone who's dabbled in, I don't know, studies or medicine is necessarily a doctor. And I think we have to be very careful about it, because we give the different kind of
right.
the wrong impression as to what we're referring to. I'm not judging their knowledge, but the kind of theologian should not be applied to the teachers of theology, who simply, for the time being, are always selected amongst students, sorry, graduates
right,
of that particular
right,
department.
Right, right.
And it's known very well, certainly in Greece, that many people enter the department because that kind of gives them an easy route to some kind of teaching post somewhere, which is actually,
right.
as it were, preserved for that kind of group, rather than if you wanted to teach mathematics or...
Sure, absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
The same thing, we wouldn't say someone who studied mathematics is a mathematician. So,
well,
that
yeah.
word is a very different one, but I think it matters in the...
You're absolutely right. In Greece they do, though. They call them theologians, so...
But it's true in English.
But let's do better.
Let's do
better.
I thought we were going
through
a lot of
No, of course.
We could call them so-called theologians.
Oh, so
no, but it's true, and it's reflected in the way that this debate is playing out, because they're not actually fighting about they're not actually trying to defend religion in the schools as much as they're defending their jobs.
Yeah.
It's very much a union, and it's about not wanting to have to be retrained to teach something else. So.
Some priests trying to do the same.
Yeah.
All right. Well, please join me in thanking Effie and Margarita for their And before you all leave, I just want to announce that on March 7th, so 2 weeks from today, we have our next seminar with our own Anna Tsipsoulou, who is the MBG postdoctoral fellow, who will be talking about Beyond Crisis, Constitutional Change in Greece After the Memoranda. So I hope you'll join us again.